Good evening, I'm Allie Lightfoot. Welcome to the North Fork Storytellers. This is a collaboration between KVNF and the Blue Sage Center for the Arts in Paonia. This series brings together talented people from around the North Fork Valley to tell true stories on a common theme. For our spring edition of the show, we chose the theme, The Birds and the Bees. High Country News Managing Editor and KVNF Board Member Brian Calvert and I produced this series. Brian is the MC at the events and will be introducing our speakers. These stories were recorded at Fresh and Wild in Paonia in April of 2016. Part 2 of the North Fork Storytellers features Alex Carr Johnson, Gary Hall, Julia Bowman, Jake Ryan, and Lindy Marinas.
I'm going to bring up our next storyteller. That's going to be Alex Carr Johnson. He's the executive director of the Western Slope Conservation Center here in Paonia. Let's give Alex a big round of applause. Alex.
Thanks to Allie and Brian. I think this is an incredible event, and I think it's a huge gift to our community and making our community richer and stronger every time we meet and tell stories. When the birds and the bees came up, I immediately thought of birds, actually, and a very particular story I have about some very particular birds. A few years ago, I had the honor of working and living in Yosemite National Park in the Central Sierra, and it's I very quickly realized that it's a landscape that makes people do crazy things. You all have probably seen the news stories about the people squirrel suiting off of the edge of very high precipices. The summer that I was there just happened to be the summer that the record had been broken for the quickest free ascent of El Cap, and it was big news, just something that people were talking about, and I saw it everywhere. You know, everyone who I was there in this landscape was trying to do these crazy, unbelievable things in this crazy, unbelievable landscape. I admit that I, too, was motivated to take on similar feats, though I didn't attempt any records, and yeah, I guess my motivations were a little different, or at least the end products were, but I would take on journeys and adventures that I guess were a little more understated. For instance, I wanted to run from my front door to the front door of my husband's. And, you know, I just wanted to do it on a free weekend I had. Well, that trip actually was over 50 miles with over 8,000 feet elevation gain. And I wasn't going to sleep to do it, because then I would require a permit and a bear can, and that was way too much weight to be running with. I was located in Tuolumne Meadows, which is in the high country, up at near 10,000 feet, restoring meadows. And my husband, Pete, was down in the near the Mariposa Grove in Wawona. He was a park ranger, and I was a wilderness restoration worker. And so I did it. And I did it alone. And I started mid-morning and ran. Over the first pass, dropped down into the Merced drainage, followed the Merced River, went through little Yosemite Valley, went past Nevada Falls, then up towards Illilouette, and by then it was dark, and the moon was up, and I was still running, and it was such an incredible feeling that I'd never quite experienced before, where I felt like an animal. I felt like I had let go of some sort of piece of my humanness that was very freeing to let go of. I was just running through the shadows of these huge groves that had been burned out, and so there were just these tall, massive trees with no needles, no leaves whatsoever, just stark against the the sky with its incredible stars and full moon. And I camped out that night and rested, did not sleep, but rested there in this place where I knew people had lived previously from my work. You know, I'd known that that was a restoration site. And in the morning, I watched a bear at dawn just walking across the meadow, just totally disregarding me. And then I got up and continued on and reached my husband's door. And so that was the sort of adventure that landscape was calling me to do. And so along that line, Pete and I decided that one weekend we were going to summit White Mountain, which is in aptly the White Mountains, which is the range just east of the Sierra, across Owens Valley. And so it was a relatively, we thought, unambitious adventure, actually. You can drive all the way along the ridgeline up to 12,000 feet. And then from there, it's only 2,000 feet elevation climb to get to the summit. It's about 7 miles one way from where you can stop driving up to the summit and back. And so we woke up at, we actually drove up the night before, camped right near the trailhead, started at 7 a.m. And it was just a crystal clear day. It was glorious. We started running up this road, actually. It's a very nice grade, and you know, we'd been working all summer long in the High Sierra, so we were in great shape, just feeling good, just cruising along. We kept going, we passed this research station, actually, from the University of California has a research station up there they study high alpine ecology, and so then we, you know, that was a few miles in, and we were just cruising. A few miles more, we passed the observatory. A few miles more, and then we noticed that suddenly there were these massive thunderheads over the Sierra. But you know, that's however many 30 miles across the valley, and you know, it was like all the way down in like Sequoia Kings. It was like way far south. And so we didn't think anything of it. We kept running another mile, turned back, and the clouds were starting to build in the White Mountains to the south of us. And so then we were like, okay, what should we do? And we were like, well, we're like over halfway there. Let's just, if the first thunder we hear, we'll immediately turn around. So we keep going, the clouds keep building. And then we finally get to the summit, feeling great, and turn around, and it is just this black wall of clouds to our south. And they're moving towards us to the north. And this is like 8 a.m. This is like the sort of thing you'd see in the mountains in late afternoon in the late summer, usually. But for whatever reason, this day, they by 9 a.m., 8:30 a.m., they were built and just rolling. And so we signed our name in the books. We took the time to sign our name. Looked out across this incredible valley, just took in this unbelievable expanse. To the east, there's the Great Basins, just on at range after range after range to the east in Nevada. And then we turned around and started running back. And all of this is above treeline. All of this is significantly above treeline. There's no escape. And so we decide that we are just heading straight into it. And what we're going to do is we're going to keep running until we get to our car, which was 7 miles away with a massive thunderstorm in between. And so we're cruising, we're running. And it's like running into a freight train. The thunder's popping, the lightning's crashing. It's unbelievable. We're just watching these cells grow and move right towards us, and we run into it. And it was one of the most terrifying experiences of my life. We decided that Pete was going to run ahead of me because he's the slower runner. And I was going to remain 200 feet behind him. So in case one of us was hit, then hopefully the other one wouldn't be. And then I saw the lightning strike to the right of Pete. I saw the lightning strike to the left of Pete. The hail started, and it was creating welts on my legs, my bare legs. And then in the peak of my terror, I looked down around my feet, and it was one of those moments where, you know, time stops. You just every relative notion that you have is gone, and it's just you and your body and your body wanting to continue to exist. And I look down and I see these birds. And these birds, these tiny little alpine birds, I was too panicked to even be able to identify what species they were. Tiny little junco chickadee things were skittering around on the ground. They couldn't fly away either. They were trapped here with us and just running just as we were. And so we continue on and aren't struck, and we get to we actually stop at the CU research station where people were there, and they have lightning rods everywhere on every building. They welcome us in, say, are you okay, you know, this is wild. And we're like, yeah. And there was a break. There was one wave that crested over, and then there was a calm, and we were like, okay, we're only 2 miles from the car, let's just get out of here. So then we kept going, and we got back and to our car, and we're so very thankful to be alive. And a few weeks later, my husband Pete was talking to a coworker of his, and he was recounting this story, and the man was an avid mountain runner, and he said, oh wow, that's really incredible. And how long did it take you to run that? And it, you know, it turns out we got back exactly at 10 a.m. So it was exactly 3 hours to run 7 miles, climb 2,000 feet, run back, stop at the research station, and get back. The guy said, "You beat the record by like 20 minutes." And I'm not telling you the story because we broke a record. I have no proof of this. But I'm telling you this because what gives this story meaning, what gives this memory meaning to me, is that moment when we were running and these birds were running, and all that mattered was just that very particular moment, that drive to live and to live well in this world, and to enjoy and celebrate and admire every second of it. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Alex. I'm going to bring up our next storyteller. This is Gary Hall. He's an artist and a writer here in Paonia. So let's welcome Gary. Gary, come on up.
Her name was Lisa. I can't begin to tell you as to her whereabouts today. We reached a fork in our road, and we each took a separate path many, many years ago. But I can tell you exactly where she was when I was in fourth grade. She was squarely in the center of my heart. We met at a time when all of us were learning the alphabet. At one point, I heard her speak, answering a question the teacher had posed, and I was astounded, absolutely astounded, by the intelligence that that answer showed, as well as the calm self-assurance that she had. Time went by, and one day, suddenly, the teacher announced that Lisa and her family were moving out of our state to the state of Kentucky. I didn't think much of it. There was little anyone could do when in fourth grade when it came to the decisions of adults and the decisions as they affected the children. I continued with my education. School followed summer breaks. We all made friends with one another, rode our bikes around the neighborhood, terrorized certain selected pedestrians, had battlefield fights with dirt balls across vacant lots, ran away when one of those dirt balls accidentally struck the neighbor's window. We ran through sprinklers in the heat of the summer, dove into a dozen different lakes scattered around the area, followed deeply wooded nature trails and learned about sassafras and poison ivy. We picked up random bird feathers and glaciated stones and always hoped we'd see a real bear. At times we got our mothers to buy us ice cream. We sat around in war circles talking about our exploits and learning new ways to swear. We raked up leaves in the fall and dove into them head first, watched our dads as they set fire to them. We froze during the winter, playing all day in the snow with sleds. And then finally, we reveled at the sight of the trees budding finally for the first time in spring. By then, I had reached fourth grade. Classes had already long since begun. And then one day the teacher announced Lisa had returned. I was surprised. I was surprised that she and her family had the need to come back. I did not know why, but obviously there was a reason. I was curious of what that move had done in terms of an effect on her. She soon revealed it to me when she answered another question by the teacher one day. The intelligence was still there, as was the calm self-assurance. What had changed was her voice. Since leaving, she had developed the softest, most enchanting southern drawl I'd ever heard in my life. I was absolutely captivated and decided that very moment I needed to know more about this girl. I would catch up with her in the hallways, peppering her with questions about her life in Kentucky. She calmly answered me. I stood there, hanging on every single word, sometimes closing my eyes, desperately wanting to be enveloped by that accent. It got to a point where catching her in the hallways or randomly in class was not sufficient, and one day I decided arbitrarily to walk over to her house. I headed in that direction. I became a pilgrim with a new religion, searching for my own version of a fourth grade grail. I was a bit worried when I first came to her house because of the knowledge that I would certainly be confronted by one adult or another. Those concerns were quickly dispensed when her mother answered the door. I introduced myself and asked if Lisa was there. She smiled and told me to come on in. We sat and talked as she called Lisa from the upstairs. That was the first hurdle that I passed. The second was when I walked up again one day to her house to discover a massive motorcycle parked in the driveway. And Lisa came out and told me that it was her brother's and that I should meet him. I was worried, once again, that his sole purpose was to extricate from her life every possible suitor. Those concerns were quickly dispersed with when he came out, smiled, bent over, and shook my hand with a koala bear handshake. I was completely relieved and put at ease. In fact, I was really astounded at how quickly I felt as though I'd become part of her family. Time passed, and at one point during one of my trips to her house, I learned that she was taking piano lessons not one block away from where I lived. So my next plan of attack involved going over to the music teacher's house. The first time it was 20 minutes early. I sat on the front porch, quietly waiting and listening to the sound of classical music being played on a piano at a distance. Eventually, Lisa came out and stood there, staring at me, completely startled, taken aback. She looked at me and asked me, "What are you doing here?" I looked up at her and very boldly and firmly said, "I'm here to walk you home." She was puzzled, but then... But eventually she smiled and said, "Well, okay then." And we proceeded back to her house. Shortly after we left the first street, I turned and reached an arm out toward her and I said, "Let me take your music books." She looked at me again, puzzled, and then blushed a smile back at me and handed me those books. We did this every week for the entire summer and fall. The year came and went, and fifth grade arrived. By then I had a long-standing understanding that all the boys in my group knew that it was considered unsavory to be involved with girls in any way, shape, or form. And I knew that I had risked certain ostracism and ridicule in doing what I had been doing all along, and yet I chose to continue to do so, deciding to find my own truth in the matter. Well, fifth grade arrived. Time went on. Lisa and I continued to see one another. And one day we were in class and there was a test. Lisa sat on my right. And on my left was another girl I knew, whose name was Norma. In the midst of the test, I felt Norma's elbow. And I turned to look at her, and she whispered at me, "Give me the answer to number 3, or I will tell everybody about you and Lisa." I looked at her, absolutely in shock. I couldn't believe I was being blackmailed in such a way. And then I turned and I looked at Lisa. And I looked at her and she simply looked back at me with this smile. And I waited. I waited to see what else would come. And there was nothing else, just that smile. And I think in my own mind, I was hoping, half expecting, actually totally expecting, that when Lisa heard Norma make her request to me, that she would stand up, walk over, and punch Norma squarely in the nose. That didn't happen. She just continued to look at me with that unknowing smile. And I looked back at Norma. Norma had one eyebrow raised and an absolutely evil smirk on her face. I was devastated and I had no idea as to what to do. I felt ashamed. I felt abandoned. And finally, I picked up my test paper and slipped it over to Norma. After that day, I never spoke to Lisa again. She never tried to speak to me either. We would pass each other in the halls. Nothing would be said. It would take me 7 years after that point to be willing to listen to any piece of classical music. At the end of high school, Lisa graduated summa cum laude and gave the valedictorian speech. I barely listened. I was present, but I was oblivious to what was taking place. It had become, as much as everything, a part of my past, and I refused to acknowledge it in my present. She and I never saw each other again after that point. And then, not long ago, I came down from my bedroom very early one morning before dawn and suddenly thought of Lisa. I had not thought about her in years. And the more I thought about her, the more I recalled this story. And so I sat down at my laptop and began writing about it. And the more I wrote, the more I remembered. And then at one point in the course of writing it, I remembered something I'd heard more than once throughout the course of my life. That people say that when you think of somebody, that person is also thinking of you. And so I wondered, in writing that story at my laptop, was Lisa suddenly being impressed to think about me? And then I thought, if that's true, if thoughts are things, maybe the reverse is also valid. Maybe it's more valid. Maybe what caused me to think of Lisa was the very fact she was thinking about me at that time. And I wondered, did that thought of me contain amusement? Did it contain regret? Did it contain perhaps longing? I'll never know that. There's no way. What I do know is that if thoughts are things, I have one last one to give to Lisa. I forgive you. In fact, I forgive both you and myself for our youthful ignorance. What took place was a lesson. It was practice, nothing more. And that lesson became for us whatever we took away from it in our learning. And I also want her to know there's still that place in my heart for her. It still has her name right there. But I also want her to know that somewhere discreetly placed within that same heart is a sheet of music written in her honor and her memory for the piano. Many have come and attempted to play it accurately with varying degrees of success. That piece of music is still there, waiting for an uncommon person of insight and experience and skill to step forward, to sit down, and play that piece as the composer meant it to be played. Thank you.
Wow. All right. Thanks, Gary. So I'm going to welcome up our next storyteller. This is Julia Bowman. She works here in Peony at the Western Slope Conservation Center. So Julia, come on up.
Sorry, I'm not Dakin.
Oh,
And I'm also sorry to say that my story is not about sex in the desert. So let me tell you a little bit about democracy in the desert. It's a hungry thing with a flair for the dramatic. And it really only happens when leadership has faltered and the grounds for a coup are already set. As soon as someone mentions, or in a place where plans matter, as soon as someone calls a vote, you know that the plan is about to fail. And so I was on spring break, college spring break, in Coyote Gulch in Utah, and our plan was about to fail. It was day 4 of a 4-day backpacking trip, and we were hiking to the Escalante River for 2 days, and then the route was to hike out there through one canyon, backtrack a little bit, and then hike out another canyon. So we were going to create a Y. And our group leader, Patrick, had heard from a group of Boy Scouts that the route we planned on taking out was highly exposed and highly technical and highly dangerous. But unsurprisingly, this group of college students I was with was not particularly concerned with this report from a group of sixth graders. And we wanted to go out the way we had planned. But we decided to call a vote. And unsurprisingly, as a group of college students, we decided to make the decision at the very last possible moment. So there we were at the intersection of our two canyons, trying to decide which way to go. Poor Patrick. He was outvoted. And this wasn't the first time that his leadership had been disregarded on the trip. Because after 4 days of hiking through desert country without the maps that he was supposed to bring, and after 3 nights of having to eat tortillas after dinner because we were still so hungry because of all the food he didn't pack, you could say that we were just not a happy hive. And our mutiny was not entirely unexpected. Patrick was just like, he just made bad leadership decisions. Technically, he was co-leading the group with his girlfriend, Paige, but she was pretty much useless. And Patrick would end up giving up his responsibilities to the group to take care of Paige. So when Paige was tired, he suggested that we set up camp miles before we were supposed to. And if Paige had a stomach ache, he would go to bed early with her. They would hike holding hands. And he would carry her on his back when she didn't want to get her shoes wet. As we were crossing this stream that we were following for the entire trip through these Red Rock Canyon, and so every time when she was tired and didn't want to get her feet wet, he would ferry her across the stream. So they were one couple on the trip, and me and my boyfriend were the other couple. And I will just let you know that if Jesse, my boyfriend, had ever tried to carry me across the stream, the story would be a lot shorter. But even though I was a little bit less than useless, I was not having my ideal college spring break trip with my boyfriend in the desert because I was on Accutane, so I couldn't really be in the sun. And I was on the longest, one of the roughest periods of my life. And I had not one but 2 cold sores. So I was pretty much untouchable. So So Jesse and I met doing trail work in the mountains of Colorado, bonding over conversations about pooping outside and moving really big rocks to make steps. And out of the whole group, we had the most backcountry experience. And also out of the whole group, we were the two people who most consistently and vocally told Patrick that he was being an idiot and making bad decisions. So I admit that I was part of the problem that led to this vote. So we're hiking up the canyon that we had planned on. And after a few hours, Patrick stopped the group and he's like, "You guys, we've missed our cars. Like, somehow we've passed the parking lot. We've missed the trailhead. And this doesn't make sense because we're in a canyon. Like, you don't just, like, walk by the parking lot." And so we're like, "Okay, great, Patrick. Let's pull out the map." Oh, wait, we've walked off the map. So we didn't know where we were, or we didn't know where the car was in relation to our location. And so we sent one kid up out of the canyon to look around for the cars, to see how close we were, at least like find a landmark. And so the desert above or around Coyote Gulch where we are is, you know, pretty standard. It's freaking beautiful. This red, you know, sandstone and sage all mixing together. And in the west, there's a bookshelf or like a case of cliffs. And at one point, there's a little cliff that has a notch in it as if you're turning down the page of a book to save your place. And the road runs along the bottom of the cliff. And in the middle of nowhere, it seems, there's this one pinnacle of rock rising up out of the desert, and it's called Chimney Rock. And that rock is connected to this main road by another road that just zigs and zags across the desert. And I don't know how, well, and Patrick, or the kid who went to check out to see where the car was, he couldn't see the cars, but he's like, "Guys, I can see Chimney Rock." And I don't know exactly how this happened. It was probably because we all felt guilty about the vote earlier that day, and also the 4 days, or the other like 4 days of undermining Patrick's decisions, that we all felt pretty guilty. I know I did, but before I knew it, we had left the canyon, and we had crossed the sun and the sand and the wind, and we were at Chimney Rock, which was great. But so the one other thing about democracy in the desert is that eventually votes just become this mechanism to validate whoever has taken charge. And like half of everyone keeps going along with it because they're just so over it that they're like, "Yeah, fine, that's a great idea." And then the other half is just removes themselves entirely from the political process. And they're like, "Yeah, you make the decision. That's fine." So, Jesse, after 4 days, had become our de facto leader. And he led the group in a decision about what we needed to do next. Were we going to add a bunch of mileage to our trip by zigging and zagging along this road across the desert? Or are we just going to continue to straight line it towards the cliffs, where that notch in the cliffs were? We knew our cars were around there. So whilst half the group had a vote, the other half had some snacks in the shade. I was part of that half. And I heard that there was a unanimous decision to straight line it. And I was like, "That is fine with me." But apparently it wasn't a unanimous decision. After 4 days of juggling responsibilities to Paige, who was becoming progressively needier, and the rest of the group, which was becoming progressively hungrier, Patrick had been bubbling and bubbling, and apparently he had just sort of reached the end of his rope. So as the group, the 10 of us, get ready to take a step off the road and back into the sand, all of a sudden, Patrick takes off down the road, and I, with my backpack, start sprinting after him, shouting, "Patrick, Patrick, what are you doing? We have to stay as a group. You can't just run away from the group." And he's turning back after me, shouting at me, I'm taking the road, it's softer on the foot. Mer, 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 mer. And I just realize it's hopeless. So I stop and Paige sort of like shuffles after her boyfriend and reassures me that, yes, they have a first aid kit. They have enough water. Just please come pick them up once we get to the cars. They'll be on the road. So I was like, okay, bye. And we watched them disappear down into the desert, and the rest of us just started straight lining it and made it miraculously across without any mishaps. And we're just deposited down this arroyo right where our cars were. And it was so lucky. And even luckier was 10 minutes later, as we were getting ready to go pick Paige and Patrick up, they also miraculously appeared out of the desert because they had left the road and had abandoned their plan. And let's just take a moment to recognize that that was the dumbest thing that they could have probably done, and we're all very lucky. So we're stoked. And I'm like, it's time for cheeseburgers. So we get in the truck. I'm like, see ya. Beeline it to the diner. Like, meet you there. And I get there, or the car that Jesse and I were in, and then this other car, we get there and like are so hungry. And the other cars are not there. And we're just like, where are they? We need to eat. But there's no cell phone service, but we finally like got a hold of one of the other people in the other cars. And he's like, yeah, man. So we couldn't start Patrick's car after you guys left. Someone had disconnected the car battery and broken in and stole all of his cash. We're at the gas station filing a report right now. Also, Patrick has just asked the sheriff if the sheriff can administer an IV because he is severely dehydrated. So we get in the cars to drive to the gas station, and we pull up, and everybody's in their cars except for Patrick. There's the one group with all the people who I actually like, and then there's Paige is in her Subaru, and Patrick's finishing up his conversation with the sheriff, and I watch as he finishes talking to him without an IV, and he gets in his car, and he just sort of reverses a little bit and just starts like driving away, and he stops at the road where the gas station parking lot and the road like meet, because that's safe, and then all of a sudden he just peels out of the parking lot. And I have not seen Patrick nor Paige to this day.
You're tuned into part two of the North Fork Storytellers on the birds and the bees, recorded at Fresh and Wild in Paonia in April of 2016.
Bring up our next storyteller. This is going to be Jake Ryan, who is a reporter and producer for KVNF. So, Jake, come on up. There he is.
All right. This is my first time doing something like this, so bear with me. The birds and the bees. I'm going to address the more euphemistic birds and the bees. Which I still don't understand who's the birds and who's the bees, but maybe I'll find out tonight. For me, growing up, religion and sex were always pretty intertwined. In the seventh grade, our family left the Methodist Church, which I had gone to my whole life, because the Methodists had decided that they were okay with gay marriage. So our family and several others went to a church in the neighboring town, and it was in a town called Wheaton. It was a mega church. It was three stories tall in the sanctuary with balconies and wooden railings, and all the people that went there were doctors and lawyers and had parted hair and clean teeth. And the men wore suits, and it was all very nice and very the world that they would like to see. And so I came to that church around seventh grade, and the youth group had their own building with gymnasium and all that. And around that time is when we started getting into this topic of boys and girls that wasn't an issue before, but all of a sudden became a very pressing issue for everyone. So every night on Wednesdays and every mornings on Sundays, I'd go to youth group. And there was an assistant youth pastor, I think Jeremy his name was maybe, and he was a younger guy. He was probably in his early 30s, you know, like a big easy smile. And he was like one of the cooler pastors you could like at least relate to a little bit. He didn't look like your grandpa or anything like that. And during one of those kind of awkward talks, I was in the back of the room on the wooden risers that were covered with carpeting. And he announced that he was resigning because apparently it had been discovered that he had a computer full of pornography, which is not a good thing for a youth pastor to have. There were other pastors that were still there, though, and the issue and the subject remained. Later on, actually, there came a time where the boys were in one room, the girls in the room, of course, and all of our parents came in. Grab some water here. And so in this room, all of us boys were sitting there with the pastor and our parents kind of flanking us, everyone trying not to look at anyone else. And the pastor brought out these papers, and my parents signed them, and then I signed it, and it was a contract stating that I would be celibate until marriage. Which I remember as I was signing, and I thought, this is a little ridiculous. There's no way this is legally enforceable. It was like someone kidnapping you and holding a gun to your head and saying, sign this contract that you're going to give me $1 trillion. You'd sign it, but you're not worried about your finances. There was also the two-on-one talks with my parents at home. I remember the gray couches in our living room, which had been, you know, through my childhood, the place for families to gather for birthdays and parties like that. They were old and worn out. My dad read us My Side of the Mountain out loud to me and my brother and sister. But at this point, it was now a place that I was trying to resist the urge to run away. And going through, kind of awkwardly talking about this, I think my mind blocked out most of it. But one thing stands out was that my mom said, well, you know, Jake, a lot of, you know, kids, when they first have sex, they feel pressured into it. You know, the girl feels like she has to. In your case, the girl probably be pressuring you. And I remember, like, being so offended that I wasn't, like, an alpha male enough to pressure women into sex. Like, and it stung a little bit, too, because it was pretty much true. So I was kind of conflicted growing up at that point, too, about how I felt about sex and relationships and all of that. You know, the perception when you're that age is that everyone's doing it but you, etc. But I was also a pretty religious kid. I, you know, did like the people in my youth group and church and stuff, but I went along with it. I believed it. Like, I really believed it, all of it. And so the idea of having sex if I'm not going to marry the person why would I engage in a relationship with the goal of sex if I knew I wasn't going to marry the person? It was still high school. That wasn't very practical. There weren't too many girls that I'd liked that were in my same social stratosphere. This wasn't too much of an issue because I wasn't exactly, you know, fielding a bunch of relationship offers left and right. But when I went to college, it was kind of a time for many people, self-discovery. I started reading a bunch of different books and pretty much decided I wasn't a Christian anymore and experimented with Buddhism and then became agnostic and then an atheist. And I lost a lot of the baggage is kind of a coarse word, but I lost a lot of the things that I had when I had religion, including my perspective on sex. And my first sexual relationship was in college, and it was a casual relationship, a no strings attached type thing, which definitely seems like, you know, in media and movies and things like, oh, it's the ideal. But it didn't last because I didn't like her very much. And sex itself was, it was pretty much what I was expecting. It wasn't, you know, it's not earth shattering. It's not life changing. It doesn't change who you are. But I think that that relationship kind of set the tone for me going forward. And a lot of my, almost all my relationships after that, were of that nature, I suppose. And it, in retrospect, they all seemed kind of hollow. I felt a lot of the times like I was playing a role in the relationship. And it took a while, it took too long, before I saw the damage that treating sex and people so callously, the damage that that can do. And it really, when I really saw that, it changed me dramatically. And soon after that, I reconnected with my current partner and my now fiance and the love of my life. And it was different. And I realized or learned at that point the difference between sex and lovemaking, I guess you'd say. And I realized, especially now looking back, I think this is really what my parents wanted for me. We've been together getting close to 5 years. And although my parents still don't approve because we're not married, I think that they're very, well, they love Courtney and they're very happy with us. And that feels, it's interesting because I understand, I guess, or I'm learning to understand more of where they're coming from. Courtney and I have been talking recently about kids. I was pretty, when Courtney decided she wanted to have kids, I was pretty freaked out. Because it had always been at that point like, oh yeah, well maybe not, I don't know, there's pros and cons. And then the issue came to the forefront. And I called up my friends and my brother-in-law, and I also called up my dad. And talking with my dad, he said, you know, I've got friends that don't have kids. And one of the, you know, they go on vacations and they have nice houses and things like that. But one of the things that they can't do is what I'm doing right now. They can't talk to their son. And that really hit home, and I felt and could almost see a glimpse of that overwhelming urge to do what's best for your kid and do the best things for them. And I know that's what my parents were trying to do in their own way. And in a way, I had to discover it myself. I hope that if and when we do have kids, that this issue becomes a little more clear, a little more quickly for them. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Jake. Let's go ahead and bring up our next storyteller. This is Lindy Marines. She's been living in Delta County since 1977, and she's going to give us a little insight about that time. So, Lindy, welcome, and come on up. Don't trip on the dog.
Thank you. I don't really have a story to tell. I don't really have a story to tell. I brought a poem. And I did think we were supposed to write a little bio, and just because this was about the birds and the bees, I definitely, and I guess with KVNF's sponsoring this, it made me think of, oh, honey, you turn me on. I'm a radio star. All right, I'm going to get comfortable here. Desert Rose. You unwrap your moist petals in spiral motion, slowly, beginning with sunrise. Yea, before the sun be very high, petal arms be open wide, your golden nectar with loving hunger taken, with loving understanding is given to the fat bumblebee. The solstice day is long with your splendor in yellow, pink, peach surrender, yet setting sun brings back in your petals. The starry moonlit night cradles you with thanks. When the sun rises again, you remain closed and slowly drying as your sister slowly opens her moist petals in spiral motion and you hear the bee return. So I shared this last night, and I said, okay, fine, well, good, now tell us some story. It's like, really? I'm going to start out by just talking a little bit about daylilies. And daylilies, as you probably know, with all the pods on them, when the actual flower opens, it only opens for one day. And when it closes up, you know, slowly it falls off, but others on that same stalk will open, so you can see a field of daylilies, and they just look like they're going on and on forever, but each one just has its own special day. This little poem was written 30 years ago in 1986, and at the time I was 9 years into living a very primitive lifestyle on Redlands Mesa. Redlands Mesa, if you don't know, about 20 miles here from Paonia, and the elevation where I was is just below 7,000, and it's almost like a high desert. Living there with the junipers, the jupes, and the sage, and the scorpions under the rocks, and the translucent little earth babies that are like cootie lookalikes, if you've ever seen one of those. And if you have, you'll probably be as surprised as they are if your shovel unearths one of them. And scorpions, I did say the scorpions, and also the birds, oh my goodness, the wonderful birds, magpies and the stellar jays and those little brown ones that you were talking about in your story. They certainly see them during the winter. Also the red-tailed hawk was, you know, a constant, and the occasional very welcomed visitor of the owl. Maybe not so welcome to the rabbits and the mice, but it was certainly a very comforting sound to always hear, you know, whenever you would be blessed with having an owl, especially in the evening. And then the robins would return, the harbingers of longer days and the heat growing. And so at that time, so too would return the ticks that, you know, you might find on your socks, or if you wore a long flowing skirt, you know, climbing up your skirt, because they had sensed the presence of the carbon dioxide, and they're like, yeah, a home. So in that sagebrush country, you know, there's also the wonderfully fantastic wildflowers at that level. The first one that comes out in the spring is coming out now, the little biscuit root that's blooming, and the little one that's called salt and pepper is just a very tender little white everlasting. The wild garlic that starts blooming close to the solstice, and the Indian paintbrush, and the sago lilies, the globe mallow, just lovely category of, you know, just a lovely, lovely place to live. And I did live very intimately with the outdoors, as I said, in a very primitive sort of way. Although I did, we figured out a way to listen to the radio. And that was, you know, if you looked for one of those Walkmans that would require 8 batteries, the C batteries that are 1.5 volt each, then you've got a 12 volt. And then you could kind of wire up the coils to, you know, correctly to an old car battery. And then you've got KVNF. But this is actually the story of a cactus. So just imagine that it's coming on summertime and the days are that super long, super hot, dry heat of the summer. And the sagebrush country really comes alive at that time. It's it almost feels like everything is accelerated, but it's kind of slowed down at the same time. It's an interesting little oxymoron. It's kind of like the timelessness of new love. You know, new love, the magic, the openness, the hopefulness. So I was young and in love and vulnerable. And so really this poem is a poem about infidelity. And the alternate name for the poem would be Sex in the Desert. And so I'm just going to read it again. Now that you know a little bit about the habits of the prickly pear, that, oh, or did I not tell you that it does the same as the day lily? Even though you can see, you know, numerous buds, each individual flower just opens for one day. And then you'll see more blooms. You'll have the glory of the blooming prickly pear cactus for, you know, 10 days, 2 weeks, but each one only opens once. Sex in the Desert. You unwrap your moist petals in spiral motion, slowly, beginning with sunrise. Yea, before the sun be very high, petal arms be open wide, your golden nectar with loving hunger is taken, and with loving understanding is given to the fat bumblebee. The solstice day is long with your splendor in yellow, pink, peach, surrender. Yet setting sun brings back in your petals. The starry moonlit night cradles you with thanks. When the sun rises again, you remain closed and slowly drying, as your sister slowly opens her moist petals in spiral motion, and you hear the bee return.
Thank you for listening to part 2 of the North Fork Storytellers on the birds and the bees. featuring stories from Alex Carr Johnson, Gary Hall, Julia Bowman, Jake Ryan, and Lindy Marinas. Both Part 1 and Part 2 are posted on our website at kvnf.org.